Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, international editor at Reaction. We live in an age of big tech. Innovative mobile devices, social media networks, and the companies that build them are now a part of our daily lives. But what are the consequences of this new digital age for our public spheres and our political freedoms? Does data undermine democracy? And how should we think about the power of surveillance states? With me to discuss these issues today are Benedict Evans, an independent tech analyst with decades of experience working in digital strategy and in Silicon Valley, and Ian Martin, editor of Reaction and columnist at The Times. So Benedict, over the last few months, many of us at home have obviously become much more dependent on tech and social media for communication, but also for work. Is big tech changing the human experience as we speak?
It's a nice open-ended question. I think a basic framing of thinking about all of these kinds of questions is that until very recently, technology was actually a pretty small thing. So when Netscape launched and kicked off the consumer internet back in 1994, there were only maybe 150 million PCs on Earth, and most of them were in big companies. When Bill Gates was on every magazine cover, Microsoft's actual business was selling accounting tools to big companies. And so technology was important and interesting and maybe exciting, but it wasn't actually a central part of most people's lives. It was something you read about in the newspaper and heard about other people doing. And today, 90% of people in the UK are online. 80 to 90% of people have a smartphone. There's about 5.5 billion adults on Earth. 5 billion people have a mobile phone. Probably 4 to 4.5 billion people have a smartphone. And so technology has gone from being interesting, but not actually central, to being a systemically important part of society. There was this fascinating study done by Stanford in the USA on how people meet their partners. And in 2017, 40% of new relationships in the USA started online, 40%. And I think everything else that we see around tech sort of flows out of that, that technology has become central to democracy, society, media, entertainment, our love lives. It's become a systemically important part of society instead of being something for kind of hobbyists and geeks.
And Ian, is this central place for technology a problem?
On one level, it's obviously not, because I think anyone who's been in a relatively lucky position in terms of work during the crisis has experienced the upside. We all moan about, to an extent, about Zoom or Microsoft Teams or all the rest of it. But for large numbers of people in the West and beyond, it's allowed during lockdown business to continue, family relationships to continue in a way that would have been, I can't conceive of what lockdown would have been like in Britain, in the Britain that I grew up in, you know, 30 years ago. I'm trying to think, it would have been just like one long, endless, rainy Sunday afternoon with very little contact with the outside world and little opportunity other than phone, which is unsatisfactory, pre-mobile, to communicate. So that's been incredibly positive, that businesses have been able to retool and families have been able to keep in touch. That's the very positive side of it. So I feel more upbeat about tech in that sense than I have. But the crisis accelerates the rise of tech and the change in habits and change in human behavior that Benedict referenced there. And all of the political questions about the power of big tech, just is all very new. So we're not really sure how to think about it and how to regulate it. But I wanted to begin just by being a bit positive about it. And the tools that have been created are overwhelmingly to the good, to the public good, I think.
Well, after that upbeat start, why don't we think about some of the potential negatives? One idea which has become fashionable lately is surveillance capitalism. The thinking here is that the data from our online lives is being used not only to target advertisements, but also to shape our opinions and tastes. But how accurate is this picture?
It's not a very well-founded argument. I think there's a lot of books that make great titles that you don't actually have to read. And I think taking two scary sounding words and putting them together on a title is a good way to sell a book. It doesn't really speak to any of the questions that we're actually trying to worry about. What do you mean by capitalism? Yes, so what? What do you mean by surveillance? You mean I do a search for a barbecue and Google shows me ads for barbecues, and it knows that I previously searched for barbecues, so maybe I see some more ads for barbecues. Is this a Stasi? Well, no, maybe we should think about this in a slightly more interesting way. I would give you kind of two tools for thinking about this. The first of them is we connected everybody and we connected everything, and everything gets expressed in software. And that means that all of society's problems get expressed in software, and all of our own bad instincts get expressed in software. So wrath and anger get expressed in software. Bigotry gets expressed in software. Selection bias, recency bias get expressed in software. Crime gets expressed in software. And some of these are new problems that get created because of this, because there's this new form, there's this new sphere. I think the second tool that I would give for thinking about this is that when something becomes kind of systemically important and very big and has problems attached to it, then it becomes a subject of public policy and regulation. And we regulate food, we regulate aircraft, we regulate electricity, we regulate cars, because if something goes wrong, something bad can happen and they're an important part of everybody's life. But when you say we regulate cars, what exactly does that mean? We can go to General Motors and say the cars have to be safer, but we can't tell them that you have to stop car crashes from happening. We can go to them and say you have to reduce emissions, but we can't go to them and say you have to solve parking and congestion. We can say criminals use cars, but we can't expect Ford to stop criminals from using cars. And there's sort of two axes that I would try and plot this on. One of them is there's not a problem with tech. There are many different problems or many different questions that kind of relate across different areas and different things. And congestion is not the same problem as global warming. Airbnb impact on house prices is not the same as teenage girls looking at self-harm content on Instagram. These are different questions for different people to think about. The second is that in any real area of policy, there's limitations to what you can have, and there are trade-offs. You can have more security and more competition, or you can have more privacy. And many of the things that you want to do to create more competition inherently conflict with privacy or conflict with security. And that's really how public policy works. You know, you can't have everything that you want all of the time, all at the same time. I think what's new about technology is that all of these issues, as I said earlier, have arrived very suddenly. And we're trying to sort of unpick all of them and work out how we think about them. So if you were to go to, I don't know, if you were to go and say, well, Tesco has to have childcare in every store and also has to have electric car charging and also all the stores need to be 45 stories high, we would kind of understand that you didn't know what you were talking about, because we kind of understand how supermarkets work. But when we apply the same sorts of challenges to technology, we don't necessarily have a good sense of what's the difference between a trade-off and something that's impossible, and what would the trade-offs even be, and who is it that should be trying to solve that. And we're trying to work that out very quickly. I mean, it took whatever it was, 75 years for car seatbelts to be compulsory. We're trying to do all of this in technology in 5 years.
Yeah, I think there's a really good parallel with banking. If you look at how many centuries it took for us to get our head around the idea, and we still haven't properly, adequately got our head around the idea of what it means to regulate large financial entities, still grappling with that. You go right back through Smith's analysis of the airbank disaster stroke crash. And it takes the Brits a long time to conceive of how to think about banks and what counts as being systemically important. Then there's an experience in the from the 1980s. And I'm particularly interested in this question of scale and excessive scale. That's what concerns me most about tech. I think tech is overwhelmingly positive force in terms of human development. But you can see what happens when you get excessive scale rapidly, which comes with the potential for political power and for market abuse and just hubris and generalized arrogance. In banking expands dramatically over the 70s, 80s and 90s as more people get bank accounts. Also, you get consolidation in the banking sector. What that then produces is a crisis point in the system where these entities have become so large and so powerful, cheered on by the politicians in the case of banking, that then when something goes fundamentally wrong with the system, as may happen in some unforeseeable, unpredictable way with tech in terms of our reliance on it, you then end up in a situation like you did in 2007, 2008, where the entities are so large that you have to save them. And a decade later, you're still living with the consequences of the finance sector having got so big that we needed to save it. Now, we're in the foothills in terms of technology. I don't think there are five simple things you can do on regulation or breaking up these entities which will give you the perfect answer. There is no perfect answer because it's human beings involved with all of their frailties. But I do think we need to think about it and be skeptical about the instincts and ambitions of some of the very biggest firms. I'll be fascinated to hear whether Benedict thinks those giants of the internet will naturally, you know, competition will emerge and naturally they'll be replaced, or will they carry on getting bigger and more important. But it is, it's fascinating the way politicians are probably about 10 years behind the curve on this. It's only in the last couple of years it's properly gone mainstream.
I think I would loop the break them up thing back to the surveillance capitalism thing. This is displacement. It sounds simple until you start asking questions and you start asking, well, what problem exactly is it that you would solve here? There's no question that Google and Facebook have market dominance in the online ad business. There may be antitrust or competitive problems with that, and you do a deep analysis on that, and you do a deep analysis on what you do about that. But that's not why teenage girls look at self-harm content on Instagram. And if you changed the ownership of Instagram, you would not affect that problem one iota. And so I kind of loop back to my earlier point. You need to decompose the question, because the question isn't tech. The question is teenage girls looking at self-harm content on Instagram, or maybe content moderation on social networks. But content moderation on social networks is not a competition law question. Market power in advertising probably is, but I don't think if you stop 10 people on the street and ask them why they're worried about tech, they probably wouldn't say because Facebook is overcharging Procter & Gamble for video views. There are many different questions within this.
Benedict, just on the report in the UK from the Competition and Markets Authority, which examined that question you mentioned, Google and Facebook, and the notion of them having excessive dominance in my industry in media. Do you think that report was, or exercise is just completely ill-conceived or mismanaged?
Not at all, no. I mean, I think there's two parts to this. One of them is to try and actually get in deep into a specific problem, as opposed to saying Google is too big. Well, what do you mean by that? Too big in what? Doing what? I think within advertising, as I said earlier, there's no question that Google and Facebook have market dominance. They have well over half of the digital advertising market. And so the question is, well, what do they do with that? I think when you go after that, then you need to think quite carefully about the mechanics of the market and the reasons why that dominance exists and what consequences it has and what interventions you might produce. And so one of the sort of primal mechanics of software is what we call a network effect or a winner-takes-all effect. More people use this, therefore the product gets better, therefore more people use it. This is what happened with Windows in the 1980s and 90s. It's what happened when Apple and Google then crushed Microsoft in the last 10 or 15 years. And this is very different from the mechanic that you saw with, for example, Standard Oil, which was bundling. So what Standard Oil does is they own the refineries, the pipelines, and the gas stations. And if you've got rival gas stations, you can't get any gas. And if you've got rival refineries, you can't get your product to market. Google doesn't do this. Apple doesn't do this. Facebook and Amazon aren't doing that. What Amazon does is much more like what Walmart did, which is that it has this one particular model that works very well and scales very well. And if you were to go to Walmart to that and say, well, Walmart has too much market share, we need to break it apart, what would you actually do? You could say, well, we're going to split Walmart into East Coast and West Coast. Okay, now you have an East Coast Walmart that has a monopoly in the East Coast, and you have a West Coast Walmart that has a monopoly on the West Coast. This is the mistake, that part of the problem with the way the US broke up AT&T, incidentally, is they split the long distance from the local operating companies, which were called Baby Bells. And so there was an East Coast Baby Bell and a Southern Southeast Baby Bell and a West Coast Baby Bell and so on. And that created competition in the equipment market, and it created competition for long distance. But if you lived in New York, the only place you could get local phone service was from the local Baby Bell. If you lived in California, the only place you could get local phone service was from the local Baby Bell. And the fact that there were now 10 of them, or whatever it was, didn't actually mean there was any more competition in local phone service. And so I think you kind of have to understand, well, what is the market dynamic here? What are the reasons why this company has this market share? And is the answer to try and change the market share, or is the answer to think about how it uses that market share? Which, to the point, is what the CMA is thinking around ad tech competition, which is, they're not proposing that you can somehow create five different search engines, because you can't. That's not how it works. There is actually a suggestion in there that you should be able to choose your default search engine on iPhone, which is exactly a rerun of the EU saying you should be able to choose your default web browser. What actually happened is everyone just chose Internet Explorer. And what would happen on the iPhone is everyone would choose Google. So I think one has to be kind of cautious about the idea that you can intervene, you can change the mechanics of the industry, but very open-minded in thinking about, well, what can you do to intervene in how those mechanics get applied to particular things? And you also have to ask, as I said, well, is that a competition question? The UK is attempting, for example, to think about harmful content online, and it's not a competition question. Rather, what they do is they try and create a duty of care, an obligation on people who run platforms to do certain things, because they understand that that's not because of who owns it. And if you changed who owns it, that wouldn't change what that behavior looked like.
So, Benedict, are you essentially saying that poorly conceived regulation can be as dangerous and as damaging as the perceived problem? So it's interesting that you brought up online harms. And there are plenty of known cases where people have posted perfectly innocent content online. I think in one case in Germany, for example, there was someone commemorating the Holocaust, but the online harm software took it down. The AI behind that software perceived that there was some kind of a problem with the content. Do you see this as a potential problem for policymakers as well in the future?
So there's several things to unpack here. And there's a kind of a joke that people make in Silicon Valley, which is Facebook has too much power and also it should hide this thing I don't like. You know, pick one, please. Which of those is it that you want? The second is you very often, this kind of comes back to my point about people understanding how Tesco works and not really understanding how technology works. You often get extraordinarily naive assertions about what is easy to do from an engineering perspective and what's hard to do from an engineering perspective. And also what questions are easy to answer and hard to answer. So the classic one here is it's very easy for you to spot copyright content, so you should be able to spot jihadi content. Okay. Copyright content, I'm doing a database lookup. Here is a snippet of audio. Is it in the database of copyright audio? Yes, no. Very, very, very simple. Here is a video that we've never seen before that was recorded 5 minutes ago. Somebody speaking about God in Arabic. Are they asking you to go and kill Jews? Okay, I don't think it's quite as easy to automate that. It might be a little bit more difficult. And yet you see people in major newspapers talking about this stuff as though it's exactly the same problem. And it really, really isn't. And so I was going to say, is then what you then get into is, well, the kind of one of the reasons this conversation has changed in the last 5 years is there's two things that have changed. One is much greater understanding of how much of a problem this can be, and so a much greater willingness to do something. And secondly, the emergence of machine learning that means, at least in principle, you can look at all those videos. So in 2015 or 14 or 13, if you were to say, I want you to scan every single video and look for nudity, that would have been just impossible. Like, sorry, we just can't do that. It would have been like going to British Telecom and saying in 1980 and saying, you have to find anyone from the IRA talking about terrorism. Like, we can't. We can turn off all the phones in Northern Ireland or not, but we can't listen to every phone call and look search for the word bomb. Now you can, actually. It is physically possible to scan every Facebook post and search for certain keywords, or to look for, a bad example, because of course you can scan text, to scan every image and look for certain things. To scan every piece of audio and look for certain things. The problem is that when you automate it, you're going to get false positives. And, you know, again, this is one of those things where people ask for X and then they complain that they got it. You want us to remove any image of naked children from Facebook, of course, but then we're going to remove the picture of the Vietnamese child running away from the napalm attack because it's an image of a naked child. Then you need a human to look at it. Okay, but there's 100 billion pieces of content posted to Facebook every day. So you can't have a human look at absolutely everything. You're going to need to have some sort of automated layer here. And I think this is where the kind of, to repeat my point, there's often a lack of clarity and understanding. Well, what is the problem here that you're trying to solve? What are easy and hard ways of doing that? What are the trade-offs that are involved? If you're going to create a filter that automatically removes pictures of naked people, you are going to pick up the picture of the Vietnamese child running away from the airstrike. That's just going to happen. And you're going to get false positives. And so you have to accept that. And so then if you say, we'll turn the filter off, then you say, well, look at this picture of a naked child that the filter didn't catch. Well, same problem. You know, do you want the false positives or do you want false negatives? So that's kind of one layer of problem. Second layer of problem is what I would call kind of the Sacha Baron Cohen problem, which is to say, you should just take down all the bad stuff. You know, you should ban X. You should take it down. A restaurant wouldn't allow that. And I think there's a sort of something interesting to dig in here, which is, you know, imagine we were having this conversation in 1950 about television. And people would say, is television more like radio or more like a newspaper? And the answer would be, it's not. It's television. It's not the same thing. Or imagine in 1930, we were saying, is radio more like a book or a newspaper? And there'd be a bunch of people saying, oh, it's a newspaper. And other people say, no, it's a book. And it's not. Shut up. It's not a book or a newspaper. It's radio. And you kind of have to engage with the thing in its own right. And I think the reason I kind of mentioned the Sacha Baron Cohen thing is, like, this is a new sphere. The way that speech works in this sphere is not the same as the way it works in a restaurant or a newspaper or television. And we're trying to work out what that is. There's a set of kind of engineering questions where we kind of have to understand what is and is not possible from an engineering point of view, and machine learning has changed that conversation. But there's also a set of decisions as to what you even want the engineers to do. Do you actually want the engineers to say you're not allowed to say X or Y, and where? And how do we think about that? And that's not an engineering problem.
But I think that that gets to the absolute heart of it, because what you said there about TV versus radio versus newspapers, I mean, you're right, they're different, but they all have something in common. And I think this illustrates what an extraordinary change in human behavior online is that they all belong to an edited world. So they were all, whether it be book publishing, television, radio, newspapers, the primary means of communication other than conversation, which we regulate by manners and personal interaction, everything which was communication was edited in one way or another. If it was television, there was a television editor, there was usually a delay. And with live television, there were orders given by, you know, orders given by the production team, and there's a regulator. Radio, similar. With newspaper, obviously, a really arcane and drawn out editing process. With publishing, obviously, takes months and sometimes years to do. Now, I would probably have said as a journalist 4 or 5 years ago, this is straightforward. You try and make this new world fit those old rules, the rules of the edited world, that there is always there's a filter, a barrier between the communicator and the audience. And that requires the internet to be, if you like, edited, or people to take personal responsibility, as when Zuckerberg said, couldn't possibly read and check everything that goes on Facebook. Who does that? And Bloomberg said, well, we do at Bloomberg. And what he's talking about is the edited function of a news outlet. But everything else in media had some form of editing oversight to deal with these problems imperfectly. We're now in a world in which that doesn't really seem to be possible, and we don't yet have a language for dealing with it. Is it a question of personal responsibility that we should mind what we say on Facebook and Twitter, and some people try that? Is it the responsibility of these companies? It can be to a degree. The argument in recent weeks, Facebook is under a huge amount of pressure to try and do something about this, but I'm not as convinced as I was before that there is actually even an answer. I'm not sure how you would set about establishing a set of rules by which the companies themselves, you could crudely just make them publishers, and you could use the law and you could use regulation to, if you like, hound them, but I'm no longer convinced that that would even work. I think it represents, and I think that's why it's a bigger shift in human communication than perhaps we understood early on. It is, as I said, I think it is a shift from an edited world to an unedited world.
So the analogy I was using earlier was, you know, it was not, is this a newspaper or a book? It's, is this a newspaper or television, or is it a telephone system? So, you know, we do not expect Vodafone to scan all of our SMSs to make sure we aren't sending an SMS to a friend that says that vaccines don't work, and you're allowed to say that to a friend at home. You're not really, it's much more problematic for you to put that on the front page of a newspaper. Okay, so I say that in a WhatsApp message to a friend. I say that in a WhatsApp group to 10 people, to 50 people. I put it on my Facebook page. I have 10 friends. I have 1,000 friends. I have 50,000 people following me. I put it on the front page of YouTube. This is not one thing. And so this is kind of the core, I think, of the problem with the sort of the Sacha Baron Cohen idea that this is like a restaurant. It's many different things, and there's billions of people. There are 1.5 billion people using Facebook every day. If you cut off Facebook, if you cut somebody off Facebook, that's kind of like cutting them off the telephone. Do we think Tommy Robinson shouldn't be allowed to have a phone? Do we tell Vodafone they should cut his phone off? Well, no. We don't tell Tesco they shouldn't serve him. So there's a very wide and kind of fuzzy set of different aspects to speech, to distribution, to publishing, to editing here, which is kind of why I'm trying to say it's like it's not a book, it's not telephone, it's not radio, it's something else. There's a wide spectrum of, when you say take it down, well, what does take it down mean exactly? Does that mean it doesn't make it to the homepage? Does it mean I can't say it in a private WhatsApp message to one person? And I don't think we have, this is kind of my point, that we have this is a new sphere, and I don't think we really understand what we mean when we say, well, you should edit it. Edit what? because they, yes, it has some characteristics of a newspaper, but it also has a lot of characteristics of a telephone system. We don't complain that Gmail isn't filtering all emails. If I get an email from somebody, we don't expect Gmail to block that or change how it orders the email in my newsfeed, in my feed. Is it a feed? Is it a newsfeed? What is it in Gmail? So why is Facebook supposed to do that in the newsfeed? And clearly it's not the same as Gmail. It's not the same as email, but it's also not the same as a newspaper. It is this other thing. And I think instead of kind of hunting for analogies and saying, well, if you're a newspaper editor, yeah, but you're not a newspaper editor. Well, if you're a telephone, yeah, but you're not a telephone. It's something else. And you have to kind of engage with it on its own terms and think, well, how is it that we think about speech in something that is actually fundamentally a new sphere? There's another problem here, which applies when you actually work at Facebook, which is you're a 35-year-old product manager in Menlo Park. Should you be deciding what the terms of political speech are in Malaysia? Should you decide that politician can't say that? Do you have the legitimacy to be saying that? And of course, there's always a hard case of, you know, they're denying the Holocaust, take it down. They're, you know, it's child porn, take it down. Yes, the hard case is easy. It's all that big fuzzy gray area in the middle of, you know, should we be doing that? Should we have, do we have the democratic legitimacy to do that? Because you do have to remember these are global platforms. And one of the challenges and the differences between pairing this to kind of books or newspapers or other forms of media is TV stations are national. Libel laws are national. You know, France and Britain and America have very different libel laws. And that's not really a problem for media companies by and large, because you don't really operate in different countries. Now, every now and then, like someone sues Parry Match in London or something. But, you know, basically, those are separate spheres, you know, separate countries with separate laws. And that's not really a problem. But Facebook has to operate everywhere. And so there was a case of what last year where somebody called an Austrian politician a fascist, which obviously Austrian people take very seriously, and they sued and won a libel case. And the court said that Facebook had to take this down globally, not in Austria, everywhere. And I'm sure, you know, many people listening to this will have looked at the new Chinese security law in Hong Kong, which, among other things, says that you are covered. Foreign nationals doing things in foreign countries are covered. So you can say China is an evil fascist dictatorship, and you can get arrested and charged in Hong Kong under this law. I don't think we really understand how we think about that, but it's not as simple as like Mark Zuckerberg who just pressed the button.
I think we've stumbled onto something interesting here. I mean, we're clearly struggling for a vocabulary to describe these very novel and unprecedented things. Because I think that one of the reasons why people in our age get so anxious about big tech companies, and particularly platforms like Twitter and Facebook, is because they are worried about the political implications of this, how this is changing our political landscapes, not only in our own democratic elections in places such as Britain and the United States, but also, as you said, Benedict, whether or not these tools which are being developed in these ecosystems and on these online platforms are actually going to strengthen authoritarian states such as China. So are there also legitimate reasons to be worried about this?
So there's no question that China has used technology to build a surveillance state, both in the way that it filters and controls what's on the internet in China, and also in the physical world with things like face recognition. And I think anyone who isn't aware of this should, you know, go and look at what China has done around face recognition and data to Muslims in its Western provinces. These technologies are mostly commodities or near commodities. They're available to anyone who wants to pick them up and use them. People at Google can say, we're not going to build X, but that doesn't mean the Chinese government can't build X or get Chinese companies to build X. And it's sort of ironic that there was a period now, what feels like the distant past, when people thought capitalism and the internet would open up China and kind of pull it towards more liberal democracy. And of course, what they did was they used the technology to reinforce the existing dictatorial model. What's also, I think, interesting is how far that model spreads. So there's a story that the reason why the Japanese parliament is called the Diet is that they went to Europe and they went to Britain and they went to America and looked at how democracy worked there and said, oh, we don't like that very much. And then they went to Germany and looked at how that worked and said, oh, we like this model a bit more. Emperor is in charge. We'll copy that model. So that's why it's called the Diet. And I think what you're seeing, I'm not sure if this is actually true. I believe this is true anyway, but it doesn't really matter. The point of the story is there's a lot of people now looking at the Chinese internet and saying, well, we kind of like that because we've had 20 years of being told that the San Francisco Bay Area model of how free speech works is the only permissible model on the internet. It's kind of an interesting coincidence that the internet was created in the place and in the country that has the broadest possible idea of how free speech works, because the internet is also, of course, a place where it's very difficult to have anything other than free speech. It's the old cliche that it interprets censorship as damage and roots around it, which isn't kind of literally true, but it's a model where it's hard to control what people do. Now you're seeing many more people saying, no, actually, we don't like that. We don't have to like that. We can change it. We can pass laws. We can build filtering systems. We can tell people what they can say, and we can change it. And you're seeing all sorts of sort of middle-income countries passing laws and kind of building systems that say, no, you're not allowed to say that, and we're going to arrest you if you say that, even if it's on the internet. And I think that spread sense both of the, China, shifting to an extraterritorial model of enforcement, but also that model, that intellectual model of how the internet working spreading is kind of a story for the next 10 years.
And one equally interesting phenomenon might be perhaps the fragmentation of the internet. China seeking to develop a new IP system to allow Beijing to better control what is viewed and what is consumed in its own territories. And obviously Vladimir Putin wishes to create a Russian version of Wikipedia. So the internet was supposed to be this great unifying force around the world, but do you think it's plausible that it fragments on geopolitical fault lines?
I mean, there are all these sort of grand fantasies that you can do some sort of central top-down reinvention of that particular primary internet technology. These things are too standardized, too decentralized for China to just say, we're going to invent a new X or Y. It doesn't work like that. What will happen, I think, or will increasingly happen, is different countries will have different laws. And the paradox of this is that the more laws you have, the less competition you have. So I was at a competition conference at the beginning of the year, for example, where some competition regulators were saying, well, one of the problems is we say to a company, you have to do this for competition reasons. And they go down the road to the privacy regulator, and the privacy regulator says, you're not allowed to do that. And the company says, well, get a room, guys, because we can do one or the other, but we can't do both. And that kind of comes partly to the point I was making earlier about trade-offs. Real policy has trade-offs, and you can't have both X and not X at the same time. And you kind of have to understand that that the thing you're asking for does actually have trade-offs. You want to make it easier to export your data from Facebook and also make sure that nobody can get data out of Facebook. Okay, well, which one of those do you want? Because you can't have both. And I think, which of course is the Cambridge Analytica story. And Cambridge Analytica was using tools designed to make it easy to get data out of Facebook because people complained that it was too hard to get your data out of Facebook and this was anti-competitive. Well, guess what, guys? You can't have both. So I think you will have a lot of that. You will also have different rules in Britain, France, Germany, Singapore, Australia, Brazil, America. There is a hope that you can get some kind of lowest common denominators. But what you also have is a sense that, GDPR applies globally. And, the Online Harms Act will effectively apply globally. And a lot of these things will apply globally. And this will create a load on competition. So it will be harder to compete with Facebook if you have to have 50 compliance people before you turn your product on. Or even if you have to sign up to AWS's insurance content moderation platform before you can turn your product on. I mean, I think part of the challenge here is this extraterritoriality. I think I would focus much more on that than on, fragmentation or, Chinese trying to create their networking protocols or so on. That stuff won't work. What will absolutely happen is you'll have different rules in different places and you'll have to understand that. And in a sense, that's how the rest of the world works. If you're a Brazilian company, you want to sell food in Europe, you have to think about European food regulation. Technology historically was always sort of exempt from that, and it won't be exempt from that anymore.
I'd agree with almost all of that. The only thing I would introduce is that I think there is a misunderstanding in terms of what's happened on China. People mistakenly, I think, use the term totalitarian and authoritarian as though they're interchangeable. Actually, I think China moved from, in the 80s, moved from a totalitarian system, which the state didn't, because it didn't have access to all of this technology, actually didn't really have the means to realize its ambitions, into an authoritarian system, which is obviously controlling, but not to the same extent as a totalitarian setup. What happened in 2012, which I think we all missed in the West, and this has implications for the policy of the UK as well, is that it moved to becoming once again a totalitarian setup, and that the change in leadership was back towards something much more like a Marxist-Leninist totalitarian leadership. Now, they're obviously going to be very, very excited by the potential of all of this technology, whether it's off the shelf or not, as Benedict says, gives them for complete control. What I'm surprised by is that they're interested in applying some of this abroad as well. It's not just that they want to use this for control at home. They are, as Western intelligence agencies know, and this big business knows, they are extremely active in trying to extend their reach beyond their own internal borders. But I think it's now a totalitarian state that has technology at its fingertips that the Stasi could only have dreamt of. they were using was very, very crude and simplistic compared to what the Chinese now have.
I think that, I was going to say, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a geopolitical conversation about the role of China in the next 20 years as opposed to the last 20 years and how much more assertive China is. And in a sense, how much China, you know, in a sense, echoing Russia, China was going to a 19th century idea of great power politics, that we can do that because we want to do that, and we're going to take that because we can and we want it, as opposed to the sort of the model of the last 75 years, which was, well, you can't do that because that's a nuclear war. And so everything else gets sort of moderated around the edges of that behavior. We're now moving to a model that I suspect looks much more, as I said, like 18th or 19th century power politics. This is not my field, but this is a fairly obvious observation from outside. And part of that is how you use technology to, as the police force, to control political thought in your own country. Whatever it is, you know, we move from a world, and you kind of loop back to a kind of a macro view of technology. Back in 1994, as I said, when there were 150 million PCs on Earth, probably 100 million of them were in the USA. You know, computing was basically America plus Western Europe and Japan. I think something like half of global computing capacity, including supercomputers and everything else, was in the USA. And today, there's 250 million smartphones in the USA and 800 million in China. And in 2008, I think 75-80% of all venture capital was happening in the USA, which is a pretty good proxy for where technology companies are being created. Today it's 50-50. And so we've moved from a world in which software was created, technology was basically a creation of the Western world, and today is going to be globally diffused in much the same way that, for example, railways were. You know, there was a point in time when all the railways were made in Britain because Britain invented railways, and that didn't last, not because Britain got bad at making railways, but because everyone could make railways. And the same thing is now happening with technology, and the same thing is now happening with software. Everyone will make this stuff. And I think if you combine that with the kind of the geopolitical shift back to China, and if you think of like the sort of those super long-term charts of global GDP by country over the last 1,000 years, and we're probably going to have a reversion to that norm.
Well, with those predictions in mind, Benedict and Ian, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Next episode, I'll be joined by Bruno Massayas, who'll be talking about the US-China rivalry.